A story of our time. We present The Iron Box.
This camp brings out the very best in brothers or destroys them entirely. But none are unaffected. None who leave here are normal.
The prison life and death of George Jackson, author of Soledad Brother, a book of his letters, which you will hear in this program as he recorded them himself in prison.
This is one nigger who is positively displeased. I'll never forget, I'll never forgive. And if I'm guilty of anything at all, it's of not leaning on them too hard. If I leave here alive, I'll leave nothing behind. They'll never count me among the broken men. But I can't say that I'm normal either. I've been hungry too long, I've gotten angry too often, I've been lied to and insulted too many times. They pushed me over the line, from which there can be no retreat.
So if you can imagine to be in a cell on three sides of solid brick, and on the front side, it's a mesh cage, and you stay here for 23 and a half hours a day for 2 and 3 years, yeah, I guess you can imagine what it could do to a person.
These are the things that you have to put up with, and there's no truer word spoken than Eldridge Cleaver said. There's more revolutionary to come out of these institutions than Marxists could ever turn out.
Even in spite of these conditions, the power that came across me from the black prisoners, you know what I mean, they really got a lot of man about them.
Before he went to prison, George Jackson was no leader. He wasn't even a radical. There was nothing political about his first contacts with the law.
It goes back to the very first day I was in California. I wrecked my father's car. The people, the beautiful people that were involved in the wreck, they didn't call the police. We were settling among ourselves, you know, black people. We were settling among ourselves. But it just so happened that a pig came by and saw the accident and intervened, took my name, and I got a record. I was 14.
Driving a car without a license, particularly atrocious crime.
Faye Stender, who was one of George Jackson's defense lawyers.
His second so-called brush with the law was some matters involving possession of goods, which, although it was alleged that they were stolen, George's mother was able to produce a receipt. And the offense for which he'd been in prison 10 years was an alleged robbery of a gas station.
Me and my comrade, we're both pretty well confused. We did something stupid. We drove in a place and took folks' money with my car and everything. We were both drunk, and we'd been vacationing down in Mexico when we just come back, and we were both still rather, you know, intoxicated. It wasn't anything to get excited about. No one was hurt. And the robbery was just a subconscious expression of disregard for, you know, establishment. I was 18 then.
They tied him 3 months in county jail. Before they finally brought him to court in February, he retained the lawyer. But I think the judge and the lawyer had gotten together to make it a quick case. I remember that morning very clearly. Had a witness that he wasn't in the holdup, but the lawyer wouldn't use the witness. The lawyer went before the judge. If he had a record, wasn't much he could do for him. That's what the lawyer told him.
He said he was making a deal. The deal was supposed to confess second-degree robbery, cooperate, and we'd be given county. What happened was we didn't get the county time. We went up for sentencing, and they gave us state penitentiary. I've been in prison ever since.
John Cluche and Fleeta Drumgo, the other two black prisoners, who with George Jackson have become known as the Soledad brothers, had the identical experience.
We asked him, how did he come out? Tears rolled down his cheeks. He said, well, I guess I goofed, Mother. I asked for county time, and I changed my plea to guilty. He said, but they gave me state penitentiary time.
Mrs. Doris Maxwell, mother of John Cluche.
They take you through that system, keep you off the street.
Fleeta was 20. He had a public defender, and he was told that if he pleaded guilty, then he would probably get 6 months. But he had an indeterminate sentence of 6 months to 15 years.
Mrs. Inez Williams, mother of Fleeta Drumgo. The indeterminate sentence in California was brought in as a reform. The actual time a prisoner serves is decided after he gets to jail by the parole board within limits set by the court. George Jackson got a sentence of 1 year to life.
The system in California works like this.
Mervyn Dimally, California State Senator for the Watts District of Los Angeles.
When the man is convicted, he goes to the Department of Corrections. And when he comes up for parole, another agency, the California Adult Authority, interviews him, and they handle all of the recommends for parole. Inmates are very bitter about the Adult Authority, because they clearly don't get a fair break with the Adult Authority. The guy comes in there for a few minutes, interviews them, looks at their folder, and if you just, you know, breathe too loud, it's put into your folder. He has no opportunity to refute the stuff in his folder. He looks at the folder, asks some silly questions, a lot of it, you know, are you a Black Panther, are you a Black Muslim, as if that has something to do with a man's rehabilitation. And then he's not given parole.
Parole board is constantly denying my parole.
Fleeter Drumgo.
You know, they come up with way out of questions like, say, you don't like my color, you know, just like that out the blue. So it's not that I didn't like his color, you know, I didn't like the system he represents.
You have to understand that every time a guard doesn't like the way a prisoner behaves, they simply whip out a form and write up whatever it is they want and stick it in his file. And George Jackson, there you are. There is indeed a very thick file.
First prerequisite is to confess. The board demands that. The board requires that. Before you ever consider for a parole or anything like that, you have to admit you're here. That's supposed to be the first step towards being broken, what they call rehabilitation. A sign of submission, really. And at the time, I was thinking about, you know, doing a year, maybe 15 months, 18 months, and going out. But the shocks and strains of prison life showed me right away that I would probably do more than 18 months.
February 25th, 1965. Dear Mother, you should start writing letters to the Adult Authority now. The more, the better. June 1965. Dear Mother, nothing will help me now but patience, when I have developed plenty. You know the things which they have locked me up for now could mean spending the next 5 years in confinement here. It would be merely a flight from reality to think that I could get a date this year. I would be happy, though, to just know how long I would be held. Even if it was 10 years, I'd feel better knowing. Take care of yourself.
Any institution in California is for the purpose of, number one, retaining custody, because that's one of the things that we're charged with, is keeping them in here until a sentence is put upon them by society is served.
The superintendent of Soledad, Cletus J. Fitzharris.
The second and equally important objective is to send a man out better equipped and better able in terms of skill and in terms of attitude to get along successfully as a citizen in the community again. Most of them have had very difficult lives, and most of them, for instance, are in need of education. Most of them are in need of some better understanding of themselves so they can understand some of their drives and behavior patterns.
Well, I've read, for the first 4 years, I read in economics, pure economics. I went through the whole gambit.
And these things we hope to accomplish while they're here, to change these, to supply these needs and to get them education.
The second 4 years, I read exclusively in military things.
We will have nearly 300 graduate from high school on the 11th of July. That's about 10% of our total population.
Guerrilla warfare, Mao Zedong. I read Nkrumah's stuff.
And give them education or furnish it for them.
I read Jacques, Vol Nguyen Jacques.
150 have completed a phase of their vocational training program.
People's Army, People's War.
And there will be in the neighborhood of 50 or 60 who will receive their literacy achievement.
I surmise that if I'd have stayed on the street, I'd probably be dead right now, humping the ground or dope thing or something like that. Prison was an educational thing for me.
I think the attitude is good here, as good as it is in any other institution of a similar inmate composition. I think we have not much different attitude than we find on the outside among the citizens, who are, some of whom are unhappy with their role in life and are protesting.
I do not know how many of you have been to a prison. You drive up to a box and a voice comes out of the box and you speak to the voice, and then you look up and in a tower 25 or 30 feet high, is an armed guard, and this is the voice, and you're told what to do, and you go through electrically controlled gates and into the, in this case, administrative section of the prison, which is clean beyond cleanliness. And somehow you realize, in a way that is quite indescribable, that it is the presence of so much force and not the use of it which must be the most difficult part of being inside a prison, because you have not been there more than 5 minutes before you feel a combination of terror and guilt and rage which I can find no words for.
I saw all of this beautiful lawn and all of this just as though it was millionaire's estate that's so well kept up by our sons.
Mrs. Doris Maxwell.
And inside, flowers that really, you never would think there was anything wrong going on. And there was such a thing as rehabilitation. And that these men in there got the best of care. That some dumb mothers and fathers can go there and say, I know he's telling a lie. When they hear from the counselor that he did this or he got a write-up for this, they know that the counselor is telling the truth, because these floors are so well polished. And these tables, not a speck of dust. Everything is perfect.
We keep a pretty tidy household. The institution is in excellent shape. It's a relatively new institution. Buildings are in good repair. The programs are going along according to plan.
That institution was built by the people of the state of California.
Frazel Sheldon, a lawyer from the Public Defender's Office, Salinas County.
It is maintained by the people of the state of California. And we, as members of the public of the state of California, we sentence people to these institutions. We sentence first offenders there. And once they get there, there is no means of segregating first offenders from so-called hardened criminals. They're placed in this hostile environment. They're placed with the choice of go along with the rule of the inmate population, or you simply have to accept the consequences. And the general public cannot imagine what those consequences might be. And if a man tries to protect himself against an assault, he end up getting written on his jacket, violent. And because of the condition and the way the laws are set up today, he can end up remaining in prison the rest of his life. He can keep building up additional charges, and he'll never get out of prison.
Any infringement of prison rules is noted on the prisoner's personal file, his jacket. For most such offenses, prisoners can be sent to the Adjustment Center.
An adjustment center, oversimplifying it, is actually a prison within a prison.
Deputy Superintendent Black of Soledad.
An area in an institution set up to house those persons who have proved themselves to be completely unmanageable in what we call a general population situation in the prison.
So he sent me to Soledad, a place for young, incorrigible, they call it.
First of all, we tried to prevent the violent misbehavior that brought him here.
I did 2 years in the Adjustment Center from 67 to 69.
Then we do have a higher ratio of counselor to inmate in the Adjustment Center than we do in other areas. We have a very small but rather good arts and crafts program. We have a psychiatrist who spends a considerable period of his work day in that area, not nearly as much as we could hope, because one psychiatrist spread over nearly 3,000 people has to be spread pretty thin.
Almost to the point of invisibility, one would
think. Nearly, yes. All these things, hopefully, to encourage a man to get a hold of himself, straighten out, and many people do.
The records show that George Jackson spent from January 17th, 1970, to February 2nd, 1970, in one of the quiet cells. And this is during the time when we had some 9 suspects at that time, and we were scattering them out throughout the area of the Adjustment Center so they would not be in communication with each other.
The time that I spent in the O-Wing would be limited to the time that I spent after I was charged with the alleged murder of the pig down there in Soledad. That was from January of 1970 to June.
In the punishment side of O-Wing, there are 6 cells set aside, what used to be called quiet cells.
In 1966, a civil rights action was brought against the California Department of Corrections and Superintendent Fitzharris, in which the plaintiff, Robert Charles Jordan, a prisoner at Soledad, claimed to have been unconstitutionally subjected to cruel and unusual punishment. The contention arose out of his confinement from July 9th until July 20th, 1965, in one of the so-called strip cells at Soledad.
By strip cell, this is another term that needs to be defined. The strip cell only ever meant that the cell has no furnishings.
Each strip cell measures approximately 6 by 8 feet. The floor, side, and rear walls are solid concrete. The front wall is constructed of steel bars covered by a metal screen. The cells have no interior source of light. When the flaps on the outer wall are closed, the cells are totally dark, except for what light seeps through the cracks around the flaps and the outer door.
So when a man was out of control and making all kinds of noise and could not be persuaded to behave, he was put in here, and for the good of the rest of the men in the unit, so they wouldn't be disturbed by him yelling all night, we could close these doors. Inmates being housed in there had broken up the toilet bowls, the wash basins, and light fixtures and so forth. So that in 1966, when I first came back here, there were no toilet bowls in there. They had what they call oriental toilets, just a hole in the floor.
The plaintiff contended that during his confinement in the strip cell, he was forced to remain there with the flaps and the door of the second wall closed, deprived of light and ventilation for 12 days. The inmate testified that during his confinement, the cell was never cleaned. He said as a result of the cell's continuous state of filth, he was often nauseous and vomited, and the vomit was never cleaned from the cell. When the plaintiff was first brought to the strip cell, he said the floor and walls were covered with the bodily wastes of previous inhabitants. The prisoner testified that for the first 8 days of his confinement, he was not permitted clothing of any nature and was forced to remain in the cell absolutely naked.
The situation was not as bad as Jordan and his witnesses had indicated it, but the judge, not knowing, we said one thing, and Jordan and I think there were some 10 or 12 witnesses from men from up there. The judge, not knowing really who to believe, chose to just give an injunction so that if it was happening, it wouldn't happen anymore.
At the conclusion of the testimony, the court did issue the following statement. When, as it appears in the case at bar, the responsible prison authorities in the use of the strip cells have abandoned elemental concepts of decency by permitting conditions to prevail of a shocking and debased nature, then the courts must intervene to restore the primal rules of a civilized community in accord with the mandate of the Constitution of the United States. In the opinion of the court, the type of confinement depicted in the inmate's testimony results in a slow-burning fire of resentment on the part of the inmates until it finally explodes in open revolt.
I mean, they have all these guys locked up, man. You know, if they see a guy stand up being a man, you know, they try to say it's not a rehabilitation thing. It's a corruption thing.
Because a convict can get along with another convict as long as he's not harassed by the pig police, you know.
In the summer of 1970, the prison authorities thought that Soledad was getting a bad name. They decided to let reporters in to talk to the prisoners for themselves. Here are some of the things they heard.
Police provoke all this racial tension, you know. They set people up. They let a white convict out with a racist convict, you know, and right there is naturally going to be a hassle between the two convicts, you know.
Segregation and get rid of Moody, the captain.
Captain starts more race riots than anybody.
If they would allow inmates to talk their problem out among each other instead of trying to perpetrate that colonial policy that they have, as far as divide and conquer one race against the other, you wouldn't have none of the problem that you have in this institution.
Oh, I think it'd be a pretty good thing if you get rid of the niggers.
You know what? Segregate's the only way to make it. Segregate's the only way we can make it.
Well, there's many of us in here that don't think this way about segregation. We recognize that the black man is also our brothers in the struggle against the stinking big establishment. That's it, period. But then there's 70% of them that are against the establishment also, but due to their previous conditioning, that they can't see that we're all just simply the victims. That's all, you see. And once this is recognized, once we get together, it's finished. They got to go down. And as for being a traitor to the white race, for many of us that only recognize one race, and that's the human race.
Anything that you try to do to bring about unity among the prisoners, because you have to be hip to this man, what his trip is, what he's doing. You see, you have to know the way he functions. If you don't know, you're going to constantly be enraged.
This allegation is kind of ridiculous on the surface, it seems to me, because why would the officers agitate some trouble and then have to go in and physically restrain people to stop the trouble? It wouldn't be smart to agitate something and have to go in and stop it. But I don't think we have a great deal of racial antipathy.
You have racism from all sides, man. I'm not a racist. I raised a girl better because I begin to realize that a lot of the white inmates are acting in this institution from what they read off of. And this is racism, they read off of racism, and they're only acting out and haven't stopped to think what's actually happening. So I raised a bug. And I can see that we will have to move with people outside who are concerned, black, white, brown, red, whatever they are, about the problem in America.
The dudes is in it, you know, because they shipping us to the hole every day. They're killing us. If they were serious about anything, they would have told them, you understand me, to take them down to the hole and go over that, or go on the wing and see the condition that we have to live in, or check the food. Every time somebody comes here, you understand, they dress up things, you know. They make things look real good. Then when they leave, they go right back to the same old slave plantation, you know, with a master and a slave. Yeah.
On January the 13th, 1970, a new exercise yard was opened in the maximum security wing, O-Wing, at Soledad. Each man, as he came into the yard, was skin-searched for weapons. Within minutes, a racial taunt led to a fight. A guard fired. Three blacks were shot dead. One white was wounded.
There were actually 15 men in this exercise yard, in the O-Wing exercise yard at that time. Seven black, and there were eight non-black. In other words, a mixed group. We knew that there were possibilities that trouble could occur in such a situation, and therefore, as other institutions have done, we provided a gun tower immediately overlooking this exercise area. At other institutions, this has been used with considerable success. The armed officer up there has proved to be the necessary deterrent to avoid physical difficulty between groups of inmates. This was a racial situation.
At the time I was in Soledad in the year of 1969, nine black inmates had died in that time there.
John Cluchet.
At this time, I was waiting to go on the parole release plan down at Chino, and so I worked outside the gates at the officers' homes and things like this. And I was a yard boy, it wasn't us. And I heard the shots. We had to come back inside the institution. So I goes up to my cell and I see a lot of, I don't know who they were, pigs. I just call them pigs. They came because I could see the gun tower on the O-Wing yard from my cell, since my cell was up over the roof. And they were just laughing and joking like it was all a big joke. See, everybody knows, like I've been in the hole myself, and I know that everything is segregated down there. And it's just like, you know, if it was just a setup, that's what it is. That's actually what they do in the institutions a lot, to set people up. That's how they get inmates killed.
The officer in a situation like this is instructed that if, in his opinion, what is occurring can lead to the death or serious injury of the people involved, he is to take what action is necessary to stop it.
It was murdered, man. It's supposed to be a fight or something. But you don't break up no fight by aiming in. I mean, if you shoot, you would shoot in the air for a warning or something, you know. And if you have to shoot a person, you would shoot them in the leg or something. You wouldn't aim at their heart, you know, trying to kill them.
I've heard nothing now. All we've heard is that the finding of the grand jury was justifiable homicide. We heard prior to the convening of the grand jury that the district attorney's office would recommend justifiable homicide. And this is one of the complaints, that an impartial body could not be impartial with someone who obviously was not impartial, conducting that grand jury at the district attorney's office. So far as I know, the guard was never taken off duty. I understand he's still on duty. Matter of fact, he was on duty the next day after the shooting.
4 days after the shooting in the exercise yard, the prisoners heard over the radio that the grand jury had found the guard's action to be justifiable homicide. Half an hour later, another guard, John Mills, was found dead. He'd been thrown over a landing. All the prisoners were locked up in solitary for a week of investigation. Then, George Jackson, John Cluchet, and Fleeter Drumgo were accused of the guard's murder. None had been involved in the original incident. All were known black militants.
The grand jury of Monterey County, in a closed hearing with neither the defendants nor their attorneys present, found the district attorney's evidence sufficient to indict the three men for assault and murder.
The news that the three Soledad brothers were being accused of the crime was not known to the outside world until John Cluchet managed to smuggle out a letter. It just said, "Help."
Prison officials attempted to avoid me seeing Jackson by suggesting he was a very dangerous man.
State Senator Mervyn Dimally.
But I insisted. So I spoke with him and I was shocked and horrified to observe that he was in chains. He was somewhat confused about the nature of the charges because apparently he wasn't informed and didn't have adequate counsel and was afraid of being railroaded into the chair.
These defendants come into this courtroom literally dripping with chains, leg irons, chains between both feet, chains around the crotch, locks dangling therefrom, chains around the waist.
Just talking with him and seeing him there was enough to make me a little nervous about problems and all that.
I look into myself at the close of every day, at the close of every one of these pretrial days, for any changes that may have taken place. I can still smile now after 10 years of blocking knife thrusts and pick handles, of faceless, sadistic pigs, of anticipating and reacting for 10 years, seven of them in solitary confinement. I can still smile sometimes. By the time this thing is over, I may not be a nice person. Angela, there are some people who will never learn new responses. They will carry what they incorporated into their characters in early youth to the grave. Some can never be educated. As an historian, you know how long and how fervently we appeal to these people to take some of the murder out of their system, their economics, their propaganda. We've wasted many generations and oceans of blood trying to civilize these elements. It cannot be done in the manner we've attempted in the past. Dialectics, understanding, love, passive resistance. They won't work. Dear Angela, John is a young brother. He's just a little withdrawn, but an intelligent lawyer. He's at the dangerous age where confusion sets in and sends brothers either to the undertaker or to prison.
On August the 7th, 1970, Jonathan Jackson was shot dead by prison guards in the parking lot of the Marin County Courthouse near San Francisco. Two black prisoners from San Quentin, William Christmas and James McLean, were killed with him. A third, Rochelle McGee, was seriously wounded and is now standing trial for his life with Angela Davis. The four men had kidnapped the judge and two jurymen from the courtroom in an attempt to force the release of the Soledad brothers and to publicize conditions in the prisons.
I've begun to ask myself some serious questions about what society is doing to a fellow man, and in particular black men. Why do so many able black men find themselves in prison?
The act of firing into that truck in complete disregard of the lives of five non-combatants, one of them a Superior Court judge, that's really frightening. First shots were fired by the establishment's watchdogs. To me, it seems that the proper signals to become alarmed over is the fact that the establishment has created a force and given guns to animals that they don't seem to have any restraints at all.
On July the 28th, 1971, George Jackson recorded an interview with a reporter from Pacifica Radio. This was almost certainly the last recording he made. It therefore becomes the final statement of his position.
My politics, the Panther politics, of course,
a combination of Mao think and Guevara think, the two-stage revolution, and of course the focal motor thing. I mean, I'm talking about Mao's theory of revolution in two stages. One of my principal beliefs is that the fact that we're the most oppressed segment of society, that we're at the bottom of the pyramid, we have to take the initiative. Take the initiative. I feel that our job is to begin the process. Once the process has begun, it's my hope, or our hope, that the intercommunal ideal will spread from our community to yours. But of course, we know what the term vanguard means. The problems I've noticed generally center around the fact that people don't quite understand what democratic centralism is. Now, our ideal is to project ourselves into the future, of course, but at the same time, we have to realize that we're not quite all capable. Well, all opinions are equal, and we have to have some sort of centralism. Our preference, of course, is democratic centralism, you know. And people don't understand that that's a necessity at this stage. But right now, we have to have the guidance and the purposeful leadership of a vanguard party. Like Lenin says, a central committee, you know, general staff of the People's Party. We're talking about objective conditions. You're saying the objective conditions in the white middle class aren't correct for the political programs and the political thrust that are possible in the black community. And you're asking for alternatives. But I feel that when we start talking about objective conditions, I don't think that we should separate what I term psychological or subjective conditions too much from objective conditions. I'm saying that a man can get mad enough to fight over U.S. involvement in Indochina and so forth. A man can get mad enough to fight over that. The whole question follows the statement I made a while ago. We'll have to provide the example.
There are those who feel, and I'm among them, that it's probably real important that you get out with your ideas. A lot of people don't see that as a contradiction to doing political work and building a survival program. And what about that?
In other words, you're saying that there's a possibility of me martyring myself if I don't concentrate more on the legal aspect of the case? It's not a contradiction. If it's to our interest, and it's to my interest, you see, to let the people know that I stand for, and always will stand for, when it comes to the final explosion, when it comes to the point of whether or not I'm going to survive, I'm not depending on them to surround San Quentin.
New York Times, San Quentin, California, August 21st. Three officers and four convicts were shot and killed today in a gun battle during an escape attempt at San Quentin Prison, officials said. One of the dead convicts was George Jackson.
Apparently a gun was smuggled in and was in the possession of George Jackson.
Warden James Park of San Quentin.
They captured the officers. They murdered three of the officers. They murdered three white inmates for working in the adjustment center. George Jackson was killed as he broke and ran outside the adjustment center.
Jackson had a gun in his hand. He was shot. Inmate Spain dove into some bushes and was not shot. I think this is pretty significant, mainly because if they were out to eliminate the Soledad brothers, that they missed an opportunity to do so, because while the adjustment center was not under control, the officers that went in with guns could have shot many of them, and I'd say exercised a lot of restraint in not doing so.
The dead have been buried, but the present hearings into the attempted breakout last Saturday are not resulting in a simple reconstruction of what happened. Nearly everyone's story appears to be different.
This apparently was a carefully planned attempt to break out of the institution, a foolish attempt, I believe, but an attempt that showed, again, complete disregard for the lives of officers who did not deserve to die and three inmates who did not deserve to die.
I've just spent 7 years inside of that monster myself, and I was very close with George Jackson. We do not accept the story that was given to us. We believe that a gun was put in George's hand and he was thrown out on the yard and was murdered at San Quentin. George Jackson, in all of our opinions, was one of the most logical people we've ever seen in our entire life inside of that prison. And it's almost impossible to get out of that adjustment center. And for them to tell us that George had a gun in his hair. George has light hair, and you can see George's scalp. And for them to give us the ridiculous story that a gun was placed in his head is absurd.
I understand that there was a wig found, and that it was quite possible for him to have smuggled a weapon in, secreted in his hair and covered by a wig.
However, the San Francisco Chronicle reported on August 28th that when it attempted to recreate that portion of the incident concerning the discovery of the gun, it learned that it was virtually impossible for a model to place such a gun under a wig, as the prison officials said Mr. Jackson had done, and that when the gun was placed beneath the wig, it wobbled visibly every time the model took a step.
You said to the news conference that all the killings probably took place within 30 seconds. What
no,
was the basis?
No, I didn't say that.
This was the report that we got from the agencies.
Well, that's where you guys get all screwed up. You don't get it straight. The issue was pretty well decided about 30 seconds after Jackson and Spain broke out of the adjustment center. And, but now the murder of the officers, and I don't know what time span we're talking about. We don't have the reports on that.
He told me, and it's consistent with what all of the people interviewed found out, that there was no escape attempt.
Philip Ryan, lawyer for Rochelle McGee, the San Quentin prisoner on trial with Angela Davis.
That George Jackson was, in fact, murdered, that it was an attempt planned by prison officials and executed by prison guards to kill specifically the Soledad brothers and Rochelle McGee, that George discovered this plan and acted in the most revolutionary fashion possible. He gave his life to save those brothers and to save all of the people in San Quentin from a massacre. And he was successful in that. In addition to that, we have learned that the alleged escape attempt did not have any inmates whatsoever opening the doors in the cells in the adjustment centers, but those in fact were opened by guards. There was no weapon smuggled into San Quentin on August 21st by any lawyer or supporter of the Soledad brothers or any other political prisoner. The gun in question, the gun that was pulled on George Jackson, belongs to a prison guard, was carried secretly by that prison guard, as most all prison guards in San Quentin do carry secret weapons. He pulled it on the wrong man, and now that guard is dead, and so is George Jackson.
We're positive that a gun was smuggled in, but we don't know exactly how as yet. This is what's going on now. We're trying to put things together to see if we can come up with an answer.
We've got to deal with this. There's a war going on inside of San Quentin.
Well, everybody's locked up. We're going to keep it locked up tomorrow, and I don't know how much longer.
Right now, there's an absolute reign of terror prevailing inside that prison. Every one of these men has been threatened repeatedly. On their way to see us today, as they were brought out of their cells, everyone I saw was either black or Chicano. And without exception, they were told, "Nigger, you're going to be dead before this day is over."
In his last interview, George Jackson had predicted that the prison authorities would be driven to extreme measures to keep control.
It catches the prison pigs up in a cross. They know that the courts are in a mood now to appease. They also know that the comrades don't fear the courts any longer. That forces them to revert to terrorism. Not terrorism.
Police have formed a line. They're moving everybody down the corridor.
Move out!
What we met down here today for, after we got rid of some preliminaries, is to sit down with the warden and the representatives of the employees' groups.
Raymond Pecunier, California State Director of Corrections.
And they presented to me the requests for additional positions to make this place safe for the staff and inmates. And I approved today 43 new positions for San Quentin.
On Friday, several black community leaders went inside San Quentin to investigate charges of brutality.
It can be said that there is no disagreement that most of the injuries, in fact, all of them, occurred on last Saturday.
The authorized version of what had happened in the prison did little to calm the explosion of feeling that followed Jackson's death. Crowds kept vigil outside San Quentin. The climax came when the surviving Soledad brothers were produced in court.
When Lita Drongo and John Cliche were brought into court this morning, they had cigarette burns on their bodies. The attorneys again tried to have the judge postpone discussing any of the previous motions in order to deal with the problems of what was happening to these defendants. The judge very calmly said, almost as if in surprise, "There seems to be an air of hostility here. I don't understand why we can't do this in a calm and dispassionate manner." And Attorney Silver said that he wanted to give an offer of proof that Fleeta had been beaten, that he had burns, cigarette burns on either side of his neck, that he'd been beaten as soon as he returned to San Quentin. And Prosecutor Barnes said that this is just propaganda. And Fleeta cried out, "You want to see the burns? If you're going to kill me now." And Fleeta's mother ran out of the courtroom crying.
We were told, and according to the record, he is convalescing, and that no one in the prison has lost any limbs.
Lita was visibly trembling all over his body. I mean, he was just shaking. He couldn't stop shaking. And the judge insisted on getting on with the previous motion. And he said that he didn't see any bruises. So again, Lita took off his shirt, and you could clearly see from where I was in the spectator section, the cigarette burns on the side of his neck.
Oh, yes, yes. I saw John and Fleeta. Well, Fleeta, who's the tall one?
John,
he has blisters on his ankles due to the tightness of the ankle chains or cuffs. Some of the men are suffering from what we call Volkmann's contractures, which is a reduction of the circulation in the extremities. And we discussed this with the authorities with the hope that handcuffs and leg cuffs in the future can be so arranged as not to disturb the circulatory integrity.
And then Mrs. Maxwell, John Cliche's mother, began crying and calling out. And so then the guards moved forward to try to remove Mrs. Maxwell from the courtroom. And people jumped up to keep them from being able to drag Mrs. Maxwell out. And then the tax squad just went at it, just went out beating everybody. The worst beatings that I've ever seen in any kind of crowd, in any kind of demonstration, in any kind of riot. Just totally beating people bloody. It didn't matter whether they were the people that had tried to protect Mrs. Maxwell or not. Just any black male that they could get their hands on. A beating that lasted so long, I can't even begin to describe it. I've never seen people so totally, totally covered with blood.
The point, I think the principal point behind the prison movement is to prove them to the establishment that the concentration camp technique, the reversion to the second dimension of fascism, the terrorist face, which proved that this terrorism won't work on us, it won't stop our movement, that nothing, actually short of death, is going to stop our movement.
Your mother's not in here.
She is. She's right there, Bobby!
She's pregnant, and they've been beating her in the stomach and everything.
I'm going to try to
I don't care. I don't
want
her baby
right
without Phyllis. Thump in my head. Go on and feel it.
Oh, God.
There's more. They hit me like that in my stomach.
Oh, God. You got a bump on your head. Inch high.
That's where they hit me.
Oh, God. What is that?
They came in. They came in and grabbed Mrs. Maxwell. She was crying and screaming. They grabbed her and started throwing her out of the courtroom. Phil got up and told her to let go. They grabbed Phil. They threw him down in the chairs, between the chairs, so he couldn't move, and they put everybody away. And there was about 20 of them. And they started beating
her. August, 1965. Dear Father, I was just thinking yesterday how far I have fallen from glory. How very much of my physical freedom they have taken from me. I still have mental freedom, I hope. I realized how few of the pleasures of life I've tasted. trouble, difficulties, and sorrows have pervaded these 24 years. 24 years without one moment's mental gratification. For us, it is always tomorrow. Tomorrow, we'll have enough money to eat better. Tomorrow, we'll be able to buy this necessary article of clothing to pay that debt. Tomorrow, it will never really, well, it never really gets here. To everyone who has, will more be given. But from him who has not, even what he has will be taken away. I don't like this life. I can never reconcile myself to it. Or rationalize the fact that I've been basely used, hated, and repressed as if it were the natural order of things. Life is but an ambulance shadow, a vague contingency, the merest of possibilities to begin with. But men in general, myself most emphatically included, being at best complete and abject fools, have rendered even that small possibility there were to love and learn null and void. But I refuse to excite myself about my past or about the future. I simply taking up a task and I'm preparing myself for its execution.
In the New York Times of August the 27th, the black moderate intellectual Roger Wilkins gave this estimate of George Jackson. He was the ultimate nigger, and he knew it. A man of intelligence and dignity, George Jackson was one of those against whom American law contorts, degrades, and mocks itself. For a crime which a white youth might have received probation for 2 years, Jackson served 11 years, most of them in stench-filled solitary cells at the mercy of officials who had some need to break his will. He told Angela Davis in a letter, they created the situation. All that flows from it is their responsibility. They've created in me one irate, resentful nigger, and it's building to what climax?
You have to take in mind the statement that Warden Parks made about the two whites being killed. That statement was to incite a riot between whites and blacks so that they could cover up the real facts of what happened to George. This is serious business here. This is life and death, and it's not over yet.
What's the solution to the whole situation?
Wow. Like I said, you can't change anything in a joint until the thinking is changed on the streets, even within the prison structure. The people have to think differently about the men that are within prison in order to make the change to come about.
The objective condition may not be absolutely right in the white middle class community. But the conditions are right in the black community, and the conditions are right in the world.
A story of our time, The Iron Box, the prison life and death of George Jackson, was compiled and introduced by Godfrey Hodgson from American newscasts and documentaries of the events which led up to his death. These made available by Pacifica Radio, Berkeley, California. The readings from Soledad Brother, the prison letters of George Jackson, were recorded by the author some time before his death. The recorded program was produced by Charles Parker in Birmingham.